This Week in Radio Tech, episode 206, is brought to you by Direct Current, the tech newsletter from the engineers at the Telos Alliance. Direct Current brings you technical articles, tips, and information you can use today. Direct Current is free, useful, and engineer-approved. Visit telosalliance.com/subscribe. Doug Rowe is an engineer at Minnesota Public Radio, and his title is one we'll see more often, Media Production Systems Manager. What does that all mean? Well, Chris Tarr and I wanted to find out, so we got Doug to tell us, and you'll want to understand what he does, as the radio industry will need more people with his skills. Hey, welcome in. It's time for This Week in Radio Tech. I'm Kirk Harnack, your host. Glad that you're with us. It's our 206th show. Our show is brought to you by Axia and the Axia Element. And they're my employer, and I'm just very grateful that they also want to sponsor This Week in Radio Tech. This is the show where we talk about anything with broadcast engineering related, from the microphone that the announcer sits behind to the light bulb at the top of the tower, and now so many new technologies. We're going to spend a bunch of time today talking about streaming and managing lots of streaming and how important that streaming has become. We'll get into it with Doug Rowe, our guest from Minnesota Public Radio. Let me bring in right now, though, our co-host for the show, Christopher Tarr, the Ninjaneer, the Geek Jedi from Mukwonago, Wisconsin. Hey, Chris, glad you're here. And you're quiet. Is it just me?
Nope, it's me too.
Oh.
Sorry. I was trying to be polite by muting so that when I coughed, you wouldn't hear it. I got to remember to unmute it when I'm done. So as I was saying, among those other things, genuinely nice guy, director of radio operations at Radio Milwaukee in Milwaukee, radio guide magazine writer, co-founder of the site broadcastengineering.info, bunch of kids, bunch of radio stations. I never sleep. Help me.
Chris, you have a new set. You're not
I'm home from work today because I have this bronchial thing going on. So I'm actually in my living room. I'm sitting at the kitchen table.
Ah, okay. And usually it's a little bit too rowdy around there for you to be at the kitchen
table. Right. At night, when we were doing the show at night, I had to be in my bedroom because the kids were running around. But right now it's just me and over in the corner my dog. So we're good.
Oh. Have we seen your dog?
No, you have not seen my dog.
You ever want to play show and tell?
Well, you know, here, let me lift the see if I can lift it up here. He's actually behind me on the couch. If you look,
Chris.
Right.
Almost.
Nope. Still my dog. There he is, up on the couch behind me. See his nose there?
Yeah,
right behind my chair. Yep, there you go. He's white, so it kind of blends it. There you go. There's my dog sitting there pining for me because I'm not around. I'm talking and not petting him.
I got a couple of cats, and there's no way I can get them on the show. they don't mind. It's the nature of.
Yeah, my cat. I have a cat too, and she's around somewhere. I don't know where she's at.
Oh. Does yours mind what you say? I guess that's a no. I just wonder if Chris is still hearing us or not. All right, let's go ahead and move to our guest. Our guest is Doug Rowe, and Doug is with Minnesota Public Radio. Let's bring Doug in. Hi, Doug. How you doing?
Hi. Good, thanks, Kirk. How are you doing?
Good. Boy, it seems like you and I met some years ago, didn't we, at your place of business?
Yeah, so here at NPR, we actually were one of the first big Axia installations, roughly 2005, early 2006. We were, for a little while, one of the largest Axia networks, I think, that Axia even had around. Now I know there's a number of other folks who have eclipsed us. But at this point in time, we're still running a full facility with about four primary services coming out of our building, as well as doing Axia installs at some of our sister stations at Southern California Public Radio, and Axia installs at Figaro Courtyard, which is Marketplace Productions out in LA. So lots of Axia experience, lots of gear throughout our facilities here. So it's a lot of fun to get to take care of and spend time with.
And one thing I want to make sure folks understand we're going to talk about, where it's not an Axia show, although that'll play a little bit into it. Doug's title, I'm not sure it would quite fit in the lower third. Doug, your title is Media Production Systems Manager. Media Production Systems Manager. That's a big title, but we were talking before the show, and seems very appropriate for the kind of work that you do. And the kind of work you do is not something that most radio stations have yet, or have somebody in your position. So let's talk a little bit about what you do at Minnesota Public Radio and American Public Media there in your building in St. Paul.
Sure. So I started out as a more traditional broadcast engineer, you know, transmitter site, studio, facility maintenance, the normal list of things that folks do. As a large organization, we always also had a full-time, or still do have a full-time corporate IT team. And one of our challenges throughout the years at NPR and APMG has been balancing computer-based systems for broadcast versus computer-based systems for, you know, general computing, whether it be, you know, accounting firms or accounting or word processing or whatever else. And so it's always kind of had this gap for us where there's this, the you never know where things should fall into. Should the traditional IT team buy PCs for the studios? If so, should they be the ones to maintain the software on there? Where is that line? You know, you say, oh, well, it's, you know, engineering takes care of the broadcast software, IT takes care of the PC. Well, what if it's a sound card driver issue? You know, is that a, it's always been kind of a gray area. So in an effort to try to better cover this type of technology, a couple of years ago, NPR started a media production systems department. And we're basically bridging the gap. I mean, we're at this point in time, tier two for Axio, especially when it comes to networking, working closely with our full-time network engineer that works in the corporate IT team, side. At the same time, we're the primary administrators and instigators for our Dalit digital media system software that we're in the middle of a project right now. Primary administrators for a number of ENCO systems around our facility and around the network, working closely with the engineers. And then, of course, working closely with the IT teams for the infrastructure and administration of all of our web streams, the interconnectivity to those web streams, to StreamGuys and AdsWiz as we've been trying to grow that side of the business. And then, of course, the day-to-day support of all the folks using Pro Tools and Dalit and whatever else they can dig off the internet for use in audio production and newsroom workflows, as well as the same thing for our classical and rock and roll services, making sure they have all the content that they need and the formats that they need it and are able to get it the places they want it to go. So it's a very fun position.
Some of the stuff you're describing is kind of mind-blowing for me, who I've been a workaday engineer. The biggest place I've worked at, I guess, is where we ran 8 radio stations years ago out of Cleveland, Mississippi, just small stations, ran them out of one control room. And what you're describing to me is I've been there. It's big. You've got dozens and dozens and dozens of people with workstations, you know, for doing editing. You've got your distribute, you know, for different networks. You've got, as you said, 4, you know, program feeds that go out of your place live to transmitters, and then you've got other distribution networks and web streams and so forth. It's really amazing how much stuff goes on at a place as big as Minnesota Public Radio and American Public Media there. Boy, maybe you could just talk a little bit about that, about the scope of what you guys do as far as generating content and then delivering it.
Sure, absolutely. Well, I mean, as everything has changed with the internet and the ability for downloading and streaming and, you know, a variety of other devices upon which you can receive content, our corporate mentality has turned from being a radio station or a network of radio stations to a content producer and media distribution network. And so obviously the, you know, Minnesota Public Radio FM broadcast is a big component of that and still technically our largest component. As far as our mentality goes, it is still no more important, or I should say the streams and other vehicles for distribution are no less important than the FM broadcast. You know, a double-digit percentage of our listeners are tuning into web streams all around the world. You know, daily there's hundreds, if not thousands, of downloads of our content via podcasts via podcasts, via direct downloads, via third-party services like our iHeartRadio or Stitcher or, you know, whomever else. I mean, there's all kinds of folks we are attempted to be affiliated, or even the iTunes, Apple iTunes store. And so our goal is, you know, not just to support those things, but to make sure that there is a high level of reliability, at least as high level of reliability as the expectation has always been for the FM transmitter sites. As a company, you know, Minnesota Public Radio, as I said, is the primary organization, but we're actually a parent of American Public Media. As a function of that relationship between the two organizations, you know, we have just as much emphasis on content distribution for our own services as we do for you know, other stations that may carry a Prairie Home Companion or other programs, in the same respect and vein that National Public Radio and Public Radio International function at this point in time. So there's definitely we have tried to take the mentality that, you know, we need to approach these streams as something that's you know, just as important and need to be just as reliable as the day-to-day broadcast. And, you know, both as a respect for our content production and for our listeners who expect those things to be there. You know, not to have that would could in many cases disillusion a listener or have somebody not want to find our content because they don't think it's accessible.
And, well, I guess not only, you know, desiring to have the reliability on the streams, but the interesting thing about streams, and you guys, you know, have all this ability to make content. In the terrestrial broadcast world, you're limited by the number of transmitters and the number of licenses that you have and you can transmit with. With the internet and streaming, you're pretty well unlimited. If you can justify, you know, another stream with some, you know, some niche of programming that people will listen to, I guess you just make it, right?
Absolutely. I mean, it's interesting when I think about the history. I think the supplemental channels and HD radio for us actually were the beginning driver of that, where we started to say, well, you know, what else could we put out there? And since then, you know, even there, we were limited to only one or two additional services per station. Well, since that point in time, you know, we've moved to a point where we've started, you know, looking at the web stream as being the initiation for many services that sometimes even have grown then into an FM broadcast. You know, the popularity of a web stream changing what we may actually put on the radio at some point in the future. I've seen that driven the most with The Current, which is our rock station. The Current is a kind of eclectic mix of, I don't know the best way to describe it, but, you know, it's kind of a mix of styles of music with a lot of emphasis on local Minnesota artists. But classical is definitely getting into that. And of course, news content, you know, the idea of breaking news, especially in a global oriented perspective, has become very important. You know, we in the Twin Cities here have populations of people who are very interested as to what's happening in Egypt, very interested what's happening in Somalia because it hits close to home, even though they may be, you know, 3,000 miles away.
Yeah,
and so
yeah.
For us, it's both a responsibility to our listeners and then, of course, you know, an opportunity for us to get our content out to folks and to, you know, really push the Minnesota Public Radio, American Public Media name and bring content that people enjoy. So
this is a show where we do talk about tech. And so I just want to kind of get that set up. And also I'm glad that Chris Tarr was able to join us today for being a co-host on the show, since Chris, well, he's not. I guess Wisconsin, Minnesota, you guys are a little bit rivals, but Chris also has been and is in the world of public community radio. So I figured you two might have some things to talk about, and Chris might be able to ask you questions from a perspective that would go past me. So I'm glad Chris, are you back with us? Everything okay?
I am right here. Yes, my internet went stupid for a little bit there, but we're good.
Good deal. Well, I'm sure you've got a couple things that you want to ask Doug about, and certainly we will want to get into some of the technical things that Doug does, and maybe he's got some lessons to teach us. Maybe there's some techniques that he could tell us about that he's found particularly helpful when you're managing streaming and lots of streaming. But Chris, you got something you want to talk to Doug about?
Actually, yeah, I've been following along. You know, it's funny. The Current is actually kind of a sister station to Radio Milwaukee. We do a lot of content sharing and things like that. And we actually have a very similar setup in terms of Venco and with streaming and Axia and things like that. So I'm actually interested in hearing how he's using that. And I think one thing that I would add to what Doug was saying, he probably you know, can expand on that a little bit, but. You know, when you're talking about having the content available when listeners want to go to get it, I think that's a very important thing that public radio does, because we're supported, you know, a good part of our support comes from our listeners. They, you know, directly, we cut out the middleman and they hand us their money directly. And one of the important things about my job and Doug's job is to make sure that that content is available, that things are functioning and they're working efficiently so that that content gets into the hands of the end users. And so I'll be interested kind of hear more about some of the steps he's taking to do that, because that is a very important part of what we do in public media, is making sure that the content is available to the people who are paying us to put it together for them.
Sure, absolutely. So, sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead, Doug. No, you go ahead and ask that. I got some more coming up.
So, for us, it's in the last couple of years, especially as the emphasis on these alternate means of delivery have been pushed within our organization. We've had a lot of focus on redundancy and a lot of focus on not so much disaster recovery, but backup systems and the ability to find alternate paths or alternate ways to maintain content to our listeners in the end. You know, so from a streaming perspective, that both is internally in the facility and externally with our contracted streaming vendor, of making sure that, you know, we have high availability, redundancy, load balancing, and, you know, for us, it's really become a focus of just investing in the technology and the hardware to do that. I mean, it's not that the technology hasn't existed, it's just that previously I think the expense has been hard to justify, and now for us, instead, it's become something that to us has become very important. And the expectation that, you know, just like an FM station, little or no downtime, you know, even though it's just a web stream, quote unquote, it's no longer just a web stream, it's another service.
So Doug earlier you mentioned that the streams you're running have, you said, double digit listenership, and maybe in terms of your total listenership. What math did you use to determine when the streams became important enough that you would make sure that they're robust and that you would pay more attention, not just make it, not just the, you know, redheaded stepchild, but you'd actually pay attention to them.
Sure. And I'll say, if somebody went and fact checked me, I'm guessing we're getting close to that. I don't know the exact number in our ratios, but if one of our folks here at NPR tunes in and says, well, wait a minute, no, I'll say I'm guesstimating on that. But I know for us, part of what has helped is the Arbitron PPM aspect of things. So that's giving us, you know, some significant number readouts or some, you know, ability to compare across services, across different aspects. APMG, as a larger organization, we're lucky enough that we actually have a department here that's, you know, dedicated to that type of business analysis and data analysis, and is able to put that information together for our board and for our directors and administrative staff to be able to actually influence those decisions about, you know, where the money should go. You know, should we be, if the debate was buy a new transmitter because one's off the air, buy streaming gear, the transmitter still would probably come first. But, you know, as we then look at hardening infrastructure, that's definitely something that keeps coming up over and over as a content distribution company, not just a radio station.
Now, Doug, are you finding, I'm finding, and this is, I'm now 18 months into public media coming from the commercial world.
Sure.
Are you finding that expenditures are really, in a good way, expenditures are really moving towards equipment and capital in your facilities? Well, I've noticed recently, like, for example, you know, I've been looking at doing an ENCO upgrade. It didn't take a lot. It didn't take a real hard sell to get them to make that change. But I'm finding that, and I'm seeing this at stations across the country, that all of a sudden now there's been, and you know, in a good way, a focus put on the technology to create the content. You know, whereas before, well, you know, if you had a 15-year-old console, it's still working. But now all of a sudden it's, you know, we need to, you know, have these newer technologies because we have all this content that needs to be created. And they become a lot less hesitant to invest in that. At least that's kind of what I'm finding. Are you seeing the same thing?
From my experience, it's definitely very capital driven. I mean, that's the one of the things, even when I first started at NPR, that I noticed is operational expenses probably stay pretty steady, at least from the technology side, very capital driven. You know, if we're going to make a choice as to how we run a project, are we going to take it out of operational R&M or capital? Capital seems to oftentimes be the first choice. You know, and leaving the R&M monies for us for the, you know, more day to day. Hey, this thing broke. You know, a knob came off my hand. Send it somewhere to fix it, or you know, internally decide to fix things. The hard thing is just making the decision, where do you put that money in? And as we've gone through our facility, I mean, we went through a significant building addition in 2004 through 2006. That's when we initially added Axia into our facility. Well, we're 8 years, you know, coming up almost now on 9 years, with our Axia systems, with our Play to Air systems, with all the equipment that we installed at that point in time. And, you know, technology has changed. I mean, for us, the Axia core, as an example, that we purchased 8 years ago is now, if we were to buy the equivalent, it's probably overpowered and at the same time, you know, under-featured for the things that we actually want a system to be able to do for us. You know, it doesn't have the redundancy that we want, and at the same time, it, you know, is probably a much higher-level corporate core that, you know, we wouldn't spend the same money. We'd put the money in a different place or for different gear. As, you know, kind of a random example there.
So where do you look to kind of find out where, you know, out to the horizon to find out where you're going to, you know, with technology and what is the appropriate technology to look at? You know, for example, you know, I'm imagining that a lot of this kind of starts with the germination of an idea with your programming people or, you know, your production staff. And then, you know, I find, you know, you kind of have to be, you know, pretty much right up with them in terms of, okay, well, if that's where we're going, here's where we need to look, and here's what we need to look at. You know, how do you find yourself keeping on top of technology in order to be able to satisfy those requirements?
Sure. So for us, as I've watched this process, and you know, I'm not going to say it's always 100% of the time like this, but as I've watched this process, what I oftentimes see is mandate isn't the right word, but a strong influence coming from the content folks in the organization to want to be able to either create something new or do something more efficiently. So those are oftentimes the you know, germinations of ideas. So it's not necessarily, hey, we want to do this show and we want it to have, you know, X and put that together for us. But instead it's, hey, you know, in our newsroom right now, we're sending, copying, pasting things out of our ENPS system and putting them into emails to send them to the web producers who are then producing that but not getting updates as a story progresses throughout the day because people forget to email them. You know, what kind of system can we put together that might help with that? Or, you know, we are putting together content for radio broadcast and it's getting dubbed on a CD and that CD is getting carried down the hallway to somebody who then rips that audio off of the CD into an MP3 to turn around and post it on the web. How could we make this more efficient so that we don't, you know, we're not burning CDs or people aren't having to walk things around? That in combination with then the support and encouragement and emphasis from higher management that we want to just, you know, make things more reliable, that we want to have higher percentages of uptimes, we want to take fewer outages. When you put those two things together, it gives us in technology an opportunity to put together capital requests or project plans for things that you know, really move us forward in terms of the mission or the goals that the programming department would like to see, in combination with making sure that we have the right mentality that the systems we put together are going to be highly available and highly redundant. As far as figuring out what those technologies are, oftentimes the need drives the desire to go look for the technology. When we begin looking at the technology, then, you know, it's your normal sources, whether it be looking at NAB or going to NAB, looking at folks there and having conversations, talking to other fellow public broadcasters, talking to National Public Radio or PRI, talking to other folks in the industry. You know, having some connections in the industry certainly helps. You hear about things, you know, people who've moved from job to job and, you know, they end up with a vendor who has this product that when you start, you know, chatting with your friend, you find out that somebody has something that you really could use that's going to solve a problem for you. So it's, you know, a variety of ways to learn about the technology. I will say as well, for Minnesota Public Radio, we tend to have strong partnerships with the technology vendors that we choose. And within those partnerships, we tend to pursue development for new things that those vendors may not, you know, may have thought about but are not necessarily doing at the time. An example for that, well, a couple examples. When we did our Axia project originally in 2004, 2005, that was the big push for Element. We were one of the first stations to use Element regularly throughout our building. And there's some development that was done for soft buttons and scripting and other things that allowed us some automation functions. Same thing right now. We're in the middle of a large Dalit project here at NPR. We've rolled out our newsroom onto Dalit Digital Media Systems. we're in the process of rolling our current and our classical music services. We have commissioned development from Dalet. You know, in the interest of integration, we asked them to develop against the IP audio driver so that we are now able to use the Axia IP audio driver on our broadcast servers and production workstations. We're working with them on a music master integration that'll allow us for a fairly seamless ability to schedule and reconcile and keep the metadata sets between our music master scheduling software and Dalet play-to-air system, keeping information together. Along the same lines, we have an internal development team, so we're constantly looking for opportunities. For instance, we have a fairly homegrown digital media archive that spans back 20, 30 years. I mean, we're constantly digitizing older reels and things. We want to make that available internally for search for the newsroom or classical folks or whomever. If Yo-Yo Ma came and visited 20 years ago and he's going to be coming back, we need our classical folks to be able to search for that recording and pull it up. For us, the integration point to Dalet and to the web and ability for people to access that content both internally and when appropriate externally, really drives this idea as a content-driven company. So
we've been talking about this operation at a rather high level, a lot of ideas here. I wonder, Doug, if we could get you to kind of tell us what's under the hood.
Sure.
I'm curious about what's hooked to what? The leg bone's connected to the ankle bone. I want to hear about how you're getting things from where the content is made, and then what's the process after that? Sure. It ends up at Stitcher or TuneIn or your website. So can you take us through
absolutely.
That?
Absolutely. So focusing a little more on the content production as opposed to the specific radio broadcast side, Dalet Digital Media System is becoming, the project is in process right now, but is becoming our primary play to air, but also along those lines, our primary media asset management system. So Dalet for us isn't just a hit the button and listen to the audio go, but it's also an integrated audio editing tool in tandem with Pro Tools. So depending on the project size, we'll use Pro Tools or Dalet's OneCut audio editor. But that also has become our primary newsroom. And for classical, our primary scripting tool as well. So we're previously using ENPS. We've moved away from ENPS into Dalet for script writing. The ability to take these produced audio elements, drop them into scripts, add in all of the needed asset management fields. So Dalet has the ability to customize asset manager forms. Take that, design the forms with the information that we need, depending on the user's particular needs. So someone from the current may see different fields than somebody in the newsroom does, and then use Dalet's tools for audio export, for asset management export asset export as far as the actual metadata component goes into XML, and then hitting a variety of systems that then have the ability to parse that XML, grab that audio file, do conversions if necessary, and ideally automatically upload that to the web or to our websites or to the third-party folks. So, one of our big pushes right now is to get away from the manual clicking steps. It used to be that, somebody copy-pasted things out of ENPS and copied a file out of Dcart, which was or Netia, depending on which service was uploading content, and then, manually copying something into a web form, uploading something, and hoping the two things looked well together when it got to the website. A lot of our push now is to try to automate that, to try to get this to be a one-click step where, an approval step says, yes, this is ready, and the systems take care of getting the content where it needs to be. Our other push along this, of course, as we do content, is trying to make the content sound as good as we can. And, of course, the standards for web, because of encoding, because of bit loss as we go through that, sometimes slip a little bit. Well, for us, we've been investing in Minnetonka Audio's audio encoding and audio processing software. So as a part of this process, we're able to export something for Dalet, hit Minnetonka Audio, and do not just an encode to MP3 or MP2 or FLAC or whichever, but also do loudness, do some EQ, depending on if that's going to improve what that's going to sound like, and allow us to really put our best foot forward no matter the type of content we're putting on the web. So that's actually part of this whole workflow process as well, as, you know, a series of watch folders or a series of drop points that are all triggered based on status changes that are all coming out of the parent play-to-air system, which includes the metadata that's important for our users as well. So,
wow, my head's kind of spinning, Doug. This is this is so different than what me at my little radio stations, and what so many of my colleagues at other, you know, small groups of stations do. And yet, what you're talking about is the future of where a lot of folks need to go, or some folks already are there. But you guys certainly seem to be leading the way in terms of work technology and then the workflow that uses that technology.
Absolutely. You know, and the challenges with any of these, I mean, it's doesn't sound technology, but the workflow is always the thing that pushes a lot of this innovation. You know, as I said, getting away from having to have somebody sit in a room and double clicking a bunch of things in order to make something happen. The question always comes up, well, is there a way to automate this? But you know, our assumption is, even if we automate it, it needs to be a high level of reliability. You know, we can't have automation breaking down. We can't have it failing, because if the content doesn't, you know, if there's a breaking story and the content doesn't make it up, or makes it up after, you know, well after the fact, at that point in time, we've missed our audience. They've either gone somewhere else, or if they haven't gone somewhere else, you know, they're disappointed that they're not seeing the thing as it happened. And we certainly hear about that from our listeners. You know, so I mean, technology is important, but it's listener driven, and our listener needs are driven by the content that we produce. Along those same lines, of course, you know, as I said, I've mentioned Axie a number of times. Integration is one of our big things that we're really pushing. So the ability to integrate Axie and Dalet, the ability to, you know, not just have Dalet be our you know, dropping a bunch of files places, but also being our primary playback tool, integrating directly with Axie for of course, there's cost savings for us, you know, not having to wire out GPIO nodes, not having to, you know, invest in sound cards and, you know, higher level PCs where we can do things in the server room. All those things, again, fall into the same idea of being able to deliver a high quality product to our audiences and make sure it's highly reliable, but also make sure that we're not reinventing wheels or having to take extra steps to get that content to the end places. The ability for, on the Axie side, to be able to multicast is huge. You know, the fact that we can have one room hitting multiple nodes across a variety of devices and do different audio processing for each of those devices with just a couple of clicks of a button is also a huge thing for us. You know, we have, as I said, four primary services, but we have, with our HD supplementals, we have probably another 7 on-air services, if I remember correctly. But we have, I think, about 16 web streams and in the works ideas for probably another 10. Many of those automated, so many of those coming out of Dalet, but, you know, always wanting to make sure we have the appropriate audio processing and are making sure that it's not just, you know, slapping a Winamp playlist on the radio and saying it's okay, but instead making sure it's high quality and going to be there and reliable when we need it.
Wait a minute! Isn't that how you do it? You slap a Winamp playlist on the stream?
I would probably get a dirty look from my boss, but I'll admit we probably have a couple of those playing somewhere. But there's also detailed plans as to how to replace that and make it better. So,
hey, you're watching This Week in Radio Tech, episode number 206. I'm Kirk Harnack, along with Chris Tarr, who's in Mukwonago, Wisconsin, and we're talking to Doug Rowe. Doug is the media production systems manager at Minnesota Public Radio and their daughter company, American Public Media. He does a lot of things for them, including helping them set up streaming and studios in other locations. Minnesota Public Radio apparently isn't just limited to the confines of the great state of Minnesota. So we'll be talking about that in a few minutes. And I want to hear more specifics about, hey, how do you work out what audio processing is sounds right for a stream? And then I'm also interested in hearing about specifically, you know, what kind of things go to be a podcast that you can download versus the live streams and kind of how that workflow works. But in the meantime, our show is brought to you in part by my employer, the folks at Telos Alliance. And I want to tell you about something that's new at Telos Alliance. It is a newsletter. Okay. Newsletter, but this is cool. I mean, I look forward to this thing showing up in my email box. It's called Direct Current. There you go, Direct Current. And here's the one that just came out a few minutes ago. In fact, during the show here, I just received this one. Here's an article, what you need to know about digital audio delay. This is kind of cool. The first audio delays were tube-based, but they were garden hose, that kind of tube. Did you know that? A speaker at one end, a microphone at the other. Today's radio broadcasters can take advantage of technologies that are quite a bit more sophisticated for audio delay, as well as for shrinking and stretching program material. There's more information on that article. Go down a little bit more, and this kind of has been making news. That is that the Telus Alliance has doubled, in some cases, or increased the warranty for all products to 5 years. So it was Axia products that were 5 years. Now, the division that I run, Telus, all of our products are now guaranteed, warranted for 5 years. So our Omnia, 25-7, and Linear Acoustics. So a five-year warranty, brand new, something that we're going to really let people know about at the NAB show, but we're letting you know about it right now. And if you register your product, that is retroactive to January 1st of this year. So if you've already purchased something this year, January 1st, you can go register your product online, and the warranty is retroactively effective for 5 years. A little farther down, interesting article about found in the attic, the Studer A710 cassette deck. A little fun that we have there. And there's always a little blurb, or often a little blurb, about what we did last week on This Week in Radio Tech, in case you want to be have a reminder to catch up that way. Direct Current is the name of the newsletter. You can sign up for it by simply going to the website telosalliance.com. Telosalliance.com. And if you scroll on down toward the bottom of the page, you'll see a link for subscribe to Direct Current way down near the bottom of the page. Just sign up for it, and we'd be glad to count you as somebody who receives and perhaps even reads Direct Current. I think it comes out about every week or so. You know, if it's too often for you, you can easily unsubscribe. We've got all that working the way you're supposed to. But I've found it really enjoyable. The guys who put that together just do a great job. And so check it out, Direct Current from the Telus Alliance. That's all we'll talk about is that newsletter. Boy, if we could just get everybody subscribed to that, I think you're going to find it quite enjoyable and informative, informative too. Hey, how else would you know about the five-year warranty unless you read it there, or maybe you saw it on Facebook? All right, we're talking to Doug Rowe on this episode number 206 of This Week in Radio Tech. I'm Kirk Harnack along with Chris Tarr. Chris, you still with us?
I sure am.
All right. Now, I don't know about you, but I'm dying to know what Doug and his colleagues, what their criteria is for deciding on processing. Not necessarily the brand of processor. You know, it'd be great if they use ours from time to time, but how do you decide how you're going to do processing on a classical stream versus a talk instructional programming that kind of thing? Doug, can you speak to that?
Sure. So we have been investing. We have a combination of both a group of Omnias and some Optimods as well, or Orban Optimods. The lower bit rate, so I believe the Omnia ones, and I think they're like Optimod 60 or Orban 6200s or 6500s. I can't remember which one. But the idea there is they're optimized for lower bit rate streams, both for streams and HD radio. As far as the actual content processing, it's a combination of our program directors, one or two of our more golden ear hosts, and then we're lucky enough to have an entire ops team here at Minnesota Public Radio that does concert recordings. I mean, we record the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra, Minnesota Orchestra, all kinds of groups. Getting those folks into a room, into a good listening environment, and really honestly just tweaking things until it is what it, what they think it should sound like. Obviously, opinions on that run the gamut, and oftentimes it is mostly just that, an opinion. I'll say at one point in time, I have dialed a couple of those in, and I knew that one of our hosts who wants absolutely zero processing in his show, and the other host who wants it to sound like a local R&B station, when they both were really angry at me because they thought it sounded terrible, I thought I was pretty close. We actually haven't moved it too far since then. So, as far as what that ideal sound is, I mean, for a classical station, it's, I think, from an operations standpoint or somebody who has a good set of ears, it's what sounds the most natural, but taking into account the fact that many of our listeners are listening in a car or are listening in non-ideal environments, you know, whether it's earbuds in a subway or, you know, an FM radio or in their car or in a house full of kids with, you know, a mono speaker, you know, web radio sitting up on their countertop or something like that. We have to take all those things into account. Along those same lines, you also, I think, in your market, of course, have to take into account what your competition is doing. So for FM broadcast, you know, we did using a Golden Eagle, Aztec Golden
Automat,
Eagle.
Yeah,
thank you. Automat Aztec Golden Eagle. We did Spectrum recordings and – or not Spectrum, but audio recordings and – and analyze that both as far as loudness went and as far as where we saw folks modulating, and then, you know, had folks listen to that and made adjustments to our rock station to not match, but to what we felt was competitive with the local stations. Along those same lines, you know, for the news and information side of things, of course, it starts in the studio. So, I mean, you know, we were careful about mic selection, you know, throughout the entire air chain, what processing we need. And then it's based again on what our competitors are doing as well, in addition to just what our operational folks sound good. You know, so just because someone chooses ultra bass for their talk radio show doesn't mean that we'll necessarily do that. But at the same time, we want to be sure that folks in the car or folks listening in a non-ideal environment don't hear us disappear when they tune to our station or dial in our web stream.
So do you have you know, sort of guidelines for producers and content creators in terms of you know, audio quality, recording setup, things like that? Because obviously, you know, garbage in, mostly garbage out. So you
sure.
know, you really there's a lot of quality control on the front end as this content goes in. Do you have guidelines set up for producers like that?
Yes, and so I mean, one thing that helps us here at NPR is we are. The majority of our content is produced by staff in-house. So, I mean, that, you know, as opposed to having contractors or folks submitting things to us, that does help give us a certain degree of control that, you know, if it was purely freelancers sending in things, you know, you maybe run into that a little bit more where you don't have as much control over the actual recording process. You know, of course, our concert recordings and things are professionally done from our operations team. So in that sense, you know we'll be getting a high quality file. Along those lines, though, still, the majority of our content is recorded out in the field on Marantz recorders, typically mono, just to save disk space, although most everything is stereo. Once it gets in-house, we'll you know, do L plus R on as far as the stereo or as far as production goes. But they'll use a Marantz recorder, usually WAVE files, 44.1 kilohertz, 16-bit recordings. They'll bring those in if they need to submit something remotely, if it has to go over a 4G or 3G network and, you know, bandwidth is a concern. Typically, they'll use a standalone Dalet editor or an editor of their choice and drop compress those files usually as FLAC files. 6:1, I think, is usually the ratio they choose to use. Upload that via FTP or a Windows drop folder if they're able to get a solid VPN connection. Once it gets back into our system, Dalet does have the ability to convert on the fly. So you can mix sample rates, you can mix bit depths, you can mix file types even within one edit session. But just to try to keep things consistent, we'll actually still re-upconvert that to 24-bit, 48 kilohertz, which is our house standard, both in Dalet. We chose that house standard because we knew as integrating with Axia, 2448 was going to give us the cleanest transition as Dalet played out onto the Axia network without having to add in an extra layer of sample rate conversion. Okay. Once in Dalet, they'll edit at 2448. They'll put together their package. When the package is complete, at that point in time, it'll stay 2448 all the way throughout playout until it gets to the actual audio encoder if it's going to the web or as a stream or, you know, codec audio encoding, I guess, if it's becoming an MP3 or whatever it might be for a podcast and that sort of thing. Go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, I was going to ask with your rock station, with the current, I know you play a lot of local music and I'm sure some of the submissions there are a little questionable in terms of audio quality. I know we have the same issue here. Mm-hmm. Is there anything you can do to fix those up or do you have guidelines even for the people who submit the music?
Typically for us, we will actually push folks to submit a higher quality audio file if at all possible. So we're not playing too many MP3s or things that somebody just dropped off. Not to say that it never happens. But our folks who are actually on the audio engine side, they have good ears. They will typically give everything a listen before it goes to the radio. We rarely, if ever, have folks, you know, I mean, I'm not going to say we've never played something off of somebody's iPod, but it is very much the exception, not the norm. Same thing, we have really pushed to not, you know, do YouTube videos or, you know, grab something off the internet and play directly, both because it doesn't sound good and because it necessarily sound good, but also because you're, you know, always running that risk that, you know, something goes into buffering in the middle of the tune and now you've, you know, destroyed the listener experience because you're not providing good content anymore. You know, it's just like a CD player dying or something, but much more likely to happen.
But I know for you know, a lot of times now for music, the big thing is SoundCloud, you know, trying to rip something from SoundCloud or, you know, something like that. And, you know, that's a challenge I run into, you know, handling the audio at my station is, you know, setting up those guidelines and trying to get them to understand that it's not just because I like to make rules. But, it is, you know, those sorts of things, while they sound good, you know, on their own or the computer speakers, once you put it through an audio chain that actually has some high-end audio processing, boy, it's hard to fix that after a while. But
exactly.
I see as being one of the challenges, you know, of playing local music, especially.
Certainly. No, I mean, it's and typically if we do have something, you know, that's a new release that's only available of MP3 or something, if they feel they just have to get out of the air, you know, we have to play this today, we can't wait for anything, they will put that MP3 on the air. You know, they'll do a couple of cuts from something. But once a higher resolution copy becomes available, it's part of their workflow to go back and update that file in the system to make sure that, at least for the long term, we're playing something that's, you know, better, I guess, in that respect. The other half of that, of course, is we're lucky enough to have we always have this opportunity, but we have an in-house recording studio. You know, a lot of our local content that we play isn't, you know, Joe Schmo's band sending us an MP3, but it's us going to one of their concerts and actually recording something, or inviting them in for an in studio and actually having complete artistic control. You know, in addition to our Axia system and our studio, we've got a full, I think it's 110 Fader Neve console. You know, very, very acoustically isolated room that's, you know, basically well set up for live opportunities. And the great thing about that, of course, is it's not just a recording of, you know, somebody playing, but it's also an opportunity for hosts to be in the room to do interviews, to have a conversation, and bring more than just a performance, but bring an actual experience with the actual artist. So that's something, as a large organization, we're very lucky to have those opportunities.
Hey, okay, so here's a I'm really curious from this technical point of view. You guys have you care about your audio quality. You have a responsive audience that obviously you're talking to the audience back and forth. Which streaming audio formats have you guys decided to standardize on at this point in technology? And is it any different for podcasts that people might download from your sites?
Sure. Streaming, we're streaming MP3 and AAC. We have dropped Windows Media. We were doing Windows Media for a long time, but we were finding that was actually one of our projects. As we take a step back within Stream Guys, we've expanded our infrastructure and both on their, you know, what we pay them for there, and as far as load balancing things, and gone through a couple of conversions. As we've done that, we had the opportunity to drop Windows Media, but be able to divert customers over to our MP3 or AAC streams. As far as podcasts go, I believe we're also MP3 and AAC. I think if you go to our website, if you dig back into our archives, you can still find some real audio, but very rarely anymore. We've been going through a process of trying to convert that to actually be a more modern codec, I guess, for lack of a better word. And then along those same lines, I don't remember the bit rates right off the top of my head. Mm-hmm. I believe our MP3 streams are 64 or 128. AAC, I think, is 64. I don't remember if we have a 128 option for that or not as well. So we were very deliberate about that, though. We did a lot of listening, testing, spent a lot of time with folks, with golden ears folks within our own teams to make sure that the things we were putting up were encoding at the levels that we wanted them to and sounded good. So,
and I'm sorry, is that the same for real-time streaming versus podcasts? Like if I go download some audio from one of your websites?
That is correct. The MP3 for sure, I'm about 98% sure that our podcasts also have AAC options most of the time. And then for sure the web streams are MP3 and AAC.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Earlier you had mentioned FLAC. Do you have use for FLAC in your facility?
Primarily, we're not broadcasting or making directly public any FLAC content at this point, but we use it primarily for some of our remote reporters. We have bureaus throughout the state where we have reporters in I guess embedded, for lack of a better word. Oftentimes they'll have a state ranging MPLS network that we get through CenturyLink. That MPLS network becomes our backbone then for a lot of our content pushing, but oftentimes we're bandwidth limited to, you know, maybe only a couple of megs worth of bandwidth for pushing files. And if they're in a hurry, you know, I mean, a WAV file will crush that network connection pretty quickly for a little while. FLAC file is oftentimes the most efficient way to get something across the network to us here. So they're using FLAC. Oops, go ahead.
Oh, what I was going to ask next is, you know, okay, so inside your facility, you've got an audio over IP network, a high speed network. You're using Axia and LiveWire. So this is all linear, uncompressed, low latency, and that's all the stuff in your two dozen or more studios plus all the workstations that you've got. And then your public facing streams tend to be these lower bit rate, of course, as you mentioned, 64 kilobit and maybe 128 kilobit streams that we'd all be fairly accustomed to. So you've got great audio for, you know, as the contribution audio, and you knock it down to a low bit rate for distribution. So I'm curious about your other infrastructure. What about going from your St. Paul offices to the various transmitter sites? Is any of that audio over IP? And if it is it? Is any of it linear, or is any of it compressed?
Sure. Well, we're slowly. Well, we have a combination of things. Of course, looking at redundancy, we've implemented things usually in multiple iterations or a variety of manners, just to make sure that we can actually, you know, if a system experiences a failure, that we can continue to provide content to our sites or whichever. So for our primary, we have 37 radio stations around the state, as well as a couple of other states. I think we have one in Idaho, a couple in Iowa, and South Dakota and Michigan, if I remember right, off the top of my head. We're using actually a Pico Digital XDS system, satellite delivery system, DVB, in order to actually distribute our audio to those sites. So we have satellite downlink dishes. I believe we're encoding at 250, I think it's 256 MPEG-2, if I remember correctly, for that system, and you know, as a primary delivery. But then, in addition to that, Pico Digital's XDS system has the ability to stream. So many of our sites are on the MPLS. The other sites that aren't have standalone internet connections that with a Cisco VPN back to our primary facility here. Pico Digital can send a stream over that device over those connections as a backup audio option with a switcher at the site to choose. In addition to that, some of our sites, and then as we're doing for more and more of our remotes, we're using a lot of Comrex gear. So we're using Comrex accesses and or Comrex bricks, depending on the appropriate application, in order to provide an actual link between different sites, whether it's a temporary thing for, you know, a news conference or as we're doing, for instance, for our Sun Valley site, a pair of Comrex brick units that are the full-time STL to that site, as we weren't able to put in a satellite dish. So it's a variety of things for that as well. For most of those devices, the debate there, the trade-off is, of course, audio quality versus bandwidth, and then latency is a factor in there. Yeah. Typically, we're using AAC codecs, the AAC codec for that, and usually I think it's between 128 and 256. If it can be bumped higher, we go higher, but it's, you know, very dependent on usually the unique situation for each individual site.
Wow. Chris, we're going to be out of time here pretty soon. You got any follow-up questions here at the end?
No, I was just intrigued by listening about the content distribution and you know, using the satellite versus the internet and those sorts of things. Kind of what I'm taking away here is that it's a very non-traditional sort of setup in terms of how radio stations go with technology. How has your experience been integrating all of this equipment from different vendors? For example, Axia, Comrex, Dalet, Enco, those sorts of things. I know that, you know, fortunately they sort of talk the same language, but, you know, has that been a challenge trying to get all those things to work together?
Sure. I mean, it's everything is an opportunity, and everything has the opportunity for a challenge. typically, what we found is if we can work with the vendor, and if the vendor sees it as an opportunity for them, you know, for other potential customers, they are interested in partnering on this technology. Now, usually there are some growing pains. You know, I'll say that our Axia Dalet integration, the integration between the two pieces of software, actually was, you know, very solid from the beginning, but we went through a couple of iterations of hardware, as an example, in order to make sure that, you know, we were getting, it wasn't so much the integration that was a point, but it was, you know, having a high CPU demand piece of software that's, you know, taking a lot of system resources on the Dalet side, in combination with an IP audio driver that's trying to do, you know, low latency, full resolution, 24-bit, you know, 48 kilohertz audio streaming, for lack of a better word, all off one box. You know, so our challenges have oftentimes not been getting companies to be willing to do the integration, but it's figuring out exactly how to host that on the hardware properly. And then, you know, again, coming back to the redundancy aspect of things, making sure that when we put any of those systems together, that it's not in a way in which a failure on a piece of hardware or a failure in a network segment can, you know, cause an outage. You know, a perfect example of that, and you know, for this is a constant growing process. I mean, an example for that right now, we're in the middle of a large Axia Core replacement project where we're moving away from our Cisco 6500 that was installed 6 years ago, or 7 or 8 years ago, I guess now, to a new Nexus 7 dual core platform that allows us to dual land everything. It gives us, you know, complete redundancy. We can lose half of our core and, you know, keep theoretically every switch in every part of the building still running. But the challenge there is getting that to, you know, function as far as dual homing on PCs, dual homing on servers, and, you know, making sure that, you know, even connecting that Axia network to our business network, which is actually, you know, sometimes frowned upon, but is actually a primary core part of our infrastructure, making sure all of that can always stay up and running and, you know, no one segment doesn't take down the rest of the system and cause a problem. So,
wow. Wow, you guys have got a great plant there. I look forward to coming back and seeing this after you've done this, did this this core switch replacement, because you guys put a good amount of effort into getting your Axia system, which normally is on its own physical network, to also be present for all your business needs, including all those workstations that were out there. So I'm eager to see how that's going to go, replacing those core switches with something new.
April 29th is our cutover date. We've promised our bosses that we won't take any audio outage, and my fingers are crossed. But it's a fun project. It's we're excited, and I know you're wrapping it up here in a second, but excited we're getting to go down to Cisco Labs down in Omaha, and we're actually going to completely mock up everything with a copy of our existing core, the new core, and the other gear, and putting everything together as far as the code goes step by step and figure out exactly how to make this cutover happen without taking any outages. So definitely, definitely, again, another, you know, another way to honor our commitment to our listeners and try to make sure that the systems that we put together deliver the content as close to 100% of the time as it can.
Doug, I have enjoyed this immensely, even though probably half the time you're talking over my head. your environment there with doing so much content is just amazing. It's, you know, it's like having just dozens and dozens of radio stations and lots of professional talent. It's hard to imagine for a guy who for years was a workaday engineer at a small group. So I'm glad that you've broadened my horizons a bit on this, and I can start to see this really big picture. Chris, any last comments, parting?
No, I'm just, like I said, I'm glad we were able to get you on as a guest. A lot of what you're doing is a little, you know, I always kind of joke about that. You know, we've had, in fact, one of our guys used to work at The Current, and, you know, I always kind of joke that I'm about 2 or 3 years behind you guys. So I watch real intently with what you guys are doing as kind of a template, because I'm sure that's the direction that we're going to be going. So it was real interesting to hear what you're doing. And, you know, I just have to say from my point of view, that's one of the great things about working in public media, especially, is that, you know, we're given a lot of opportunity to work with things like this, because, you know, it's become a whole lot more than just about being on the radio, you know, with these alternate streams of content and all these different types of ways to create new content. You know, it's an interesting opportunity and something that I think is really neat and is, I think, as an engineer or a technology guy, keeps things interesting because you're always kind of forced out of your comfort zone and pushed to go, you know, up to that next level. And I think that's always a lot of fun. So it was great to hear, you know, this past hour, some of the things that you're doing.
Oh, absolutely. I know, I've always thought the fun part of this job, and especially working in public radio for me, is it's not necessarily putting out fires. You know, it's not to say it's never stressful, but it's oftentimes the challenges come in trying to figure out how to do new things. And I think our funding model helps a lot with that, as well as just a good attitude as far as our management that, you know, there's opportunities to make things better. It's not just, you know, break fix. So, no, it definitely keeps the job interesting, and it's fun to go on. It was fun to have the opportunity to come on your show and chat about this for a little while.
We're going to have one of Doug's other colleagues on a future show coming up. That's Tom Nelson. And Tom does a ton of engineering there at Minnesota Public Radio. So we're excited to have him on probably sometime after NAB. We got to go. Doug Rowe at Minnesota Public Radio, the Media Production Systems Manager, has been our guest. Chris Tarr was able to join us today, another co-host. Chris is with... tell us about your website, Chris, where you have some forums. What's that?
Broadcastengineering.info is the name of the site, and it's a great place to exchange ideas, questions, thoughts, whatever you want about the discipline of broadcast engineering. We have a bunch of great guys on there. And as a matter of fact, there's a story there that we've been around. The site's been around for, I think, 7 years now. There is a radio station, I won't get into a whole lot of detail, but was conceived, planned, built, and put on the air using help from that forum. So, you know, a guy came on several years ago and said, hey, I'm looking to get a radio station on. We had guys help him find the allocation, help him walk through the process of getting it, help them pick out gear, answer questions about building it. And so from start to finish, was able to put a radio station on the air. So it's
cool.
Kind of neat stuff over there.
That's great. That's awesome. All right. Thanks for joining us. Our show's been brought to you by the Telos Alliance and the Telos Direct Current Newsletter. Let me encourage you to go to telosalliance.com, scroll all the way to the bottom, and over on the left-hand side, there's a little button, subscribe to Direct Current. It's funny, pithy, informative, and you'll find out some cool things, like you'll find out about the new 5-year warranty on every Telos Alliance product. So check it out if you would. We're going to be back next week with another show just before NAB, and we'll also do a show live from the NAB floor in 2 weeks from today. So, glad. Hope you'll join us for that. We're going to have a good time there, and we'll see who we can grab from the floor and talk with. Appreciate Andrew Zarian being our producer in New York City, and we're going to see you next week on This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye, everybody.